Sit down.
Here, have a cigar.
No, thanks.
Well, now, the last time I saw you, you were a pretty angry guy.
I sure was. I was ready to quit.
That's what I thought.
How would you feel if you were me? I'd worked hard enough to get into that Paris office, and I'd worked hard to get good sources in Europe. I was all set. Then you pull me back here.
For your own good. You needed to get back to the grassroots. Get a little closer to people.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and in this episode, we have an interesting chat about how you get from a last-minute panic to pick a research topic to what is unquestionably important research. Our guest, Dr. Jonathan Lusthaus, is the director of the Human Cybercriminal Project and a senior research fellow at the University of Oxford, a research fellow at Nuffield College, and an adjunct associate professor at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. Dr. Lusthaus is well known for his book, Industry of Anonymity: Inside the Business of Cybercrime, which, if you haven't read, do yourself a favor and check the show notes for the details. A book like that seems like somewhere that you arrive as a researcher, so I was curious about where that journey started. I tried to find the first published article by Dr. Lusthaus, and lo and behold, I find a piece on climate change and international conflict. The link from that to cybercriminals doesn't just jump out at me, so I had to ask, what happened there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, even before the climate change stuff, I was interested in religious violence and terrorism and things like that. And my original intention, actually, when I was doing graduate study, was to delve into that area and do a master's dissertation on religious violence in some way. And I actually ended up coming to cybercrime accidentally, in that when I came to Oxford and I was doing my MSc, my supervisor at the time wasn't that keen on me studying religious violence. It didn't kind of fit with the style of sociology done in the department at Oxford. And so she was being quite helpful in terms of trying to encourage me in other directions that might end up being more beneficial in terms of the outcome of my MSc dissertation. And I realized quite quickly, as someone who was interested in qualitative work, that I needed to find something in the department that matched this interest, because a lot of the work that was being done and is still done in Oxford sociology is very quantitative, around social stratification and now around demography and things like this. And so the one area that was really strong within the department around qualitative work was on organized crime. And so I kind of thought, well, if I can't do religious violence, maybe I'll do organized crime. And there was some really interesting stuff being taught by Federico Varese on mafias and things like this. And so I thought, this is the space I'll look at. Seems like a safe area for me to focus on. And I needed to develop a topic. And just before, I guess it was a pretty common student experience, a deadline's coming up, you need to announce what your title is going to be and what the topic is. And very, very close to that deadline, Misha Glenny, who's a British journalist, had written a lot about organized crime, came to Oxford to give a seminar. And the seminar he ended up giving was actually a kind of sneak peek of a book he was writing at the time on cybercriminals. So the book ended up being published some years later as Dark Market. People might be familiar with that book. And as a result of listening to the seminar, it was the first time I'd actually thought about cybercrime at all, to be perfectly honest. I'm a completely non-technical person. Before that point, I really had almost zero interest in technology. I come at this from really the perspective of a complete outsider. But when Misha Glenny was giving this talk, I thought, what's really interesting about this is that there's people in this. I'd always thought about cybercrime as being a technical sort of discipline, technical issue. And the world he was describing was all about individuals. It was about people, about a marketplace in particular, about how they're trading together online. And I thought, okay, this is like a hidden world. And that's what got me interested. It wasn't the technology or anything like that. It was actually just a secret world, because I'm very interested in finding, in exploration, really. And so I thought, what I'll do is I'll take some of the theoretical background and some of the way that organized crime is studied within the department, and I'll apply this to this new case of cybercrime. And that was my entry point. That's what I ended up doing my MSc dissertation on. That's what started me off in the area, but I became so obsessed with it that I just kept doing it ever since. And today, 10 years later, I'm still working on pretty much the same issues that I started on way back at that time during the master's dissertation.
So you started out looking at hidden people and hidden criminals on hidden markets.
That was the start. And, these are online markets. So, you know, talking about something like dark market, the original dissertation I did was focused on a few different things, but ghost market was a British marketplace from around that period that was quite successful in the English language world in terms of, you know, the trade of credit card data and other sorts of, it was a carding marketplace, basically. And so that was really, that world was very much an online space. That's what interested me originally. It was how these people cooperating together online, how do you know who you can trust, who you can't trust? Who do you work with? Who do you not work with? How do you find people? So that was the starting point, was really that online element of it, which is how does trust work in this environment where you'd expect trust not to work, where you'd expect cooperation to be very difficult. And the puzzle I was very interested in, which was really the focus of that early work and subsequently as well, was this cooperation problem of how do cyber criminals work together when they're dealing not only with other criminals who are inherently untrustworthy in the sense that these are people outside the law, these are people who rip people off for a living. How are they overcoming that problem when you have the added problem of anonymity, where you don't know the true identity of a lot of people you're working with online, where you can't visit them and beat them up? So that was the sort of core driving question, the core puzzle that motivated my work starting out and subsequently. And that's where I really began in this effort, was trying to unpick that online puzzle, trying to unpick what this world looked like in terms of cooperation and organization in this kind of virtual space.
That seems like quite a brave choice for someone looking to focus on qualitative research. I think interviews, I think observation, I think really quite personal contact with your participant, with your subject, when I think qualitative research. And you decided that you were going to take this approach with these anonymous people.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way before. Maybe it was a little crazy, but I tend to do kind of crazy things from time to time, or maybe most of the time. But it was particularly in the context of a master's thesis where you have a limited time. It was a risky move. And a lot of other students in my department then and continuing to this point often use, you know, off-the-shelf data, something that can be easily pulled together in a short period of time so that they can produce a dissertation of some quality. In hindsight, I did take some risks. Some of the risks were collecting my own data and trying to collect my own data by engaging with not just interview subjects, but some interview subjects that are quite hard to access. And so I say that as someone who coming to this field with no background at all, so no knowledge of cybercrime and no contacts in the area. I had to build really over a very short period of time, just a few months, from zero up to getting contact with, you know, for that original master's dissertation, which became a paper published in Global Crime, was 10 interviews and then some legal data that I managed to collect by virtue of the fact that some of the people that I interacted with when I was searching for the interviews then basically pointed me in the direction or in some cases gave me access to particular pieces of legal data that were very helpful. So in hindsight, it was risky. And I remember actually the process of it, which was originally starting out by trying to contact, you know, the PR people of big, you know, cybersecurity companies or this kind of thing. And then eventually figuring out there's other ways of doing this. But I got lucky in the sense that a number of people were very giving of their time and basically to a complete stranger had no idea what they're doing, gave up their time and kind of introduced me to this world. And I still think back to those first interviews that I did. There's things that I learned that really helped shape the project in a number of ways and were kind of the foundation to the contacts that I made later on. So it's, it was a risky move. And I'd say at the time I thought, well, if I just talk to people in the private sector, I'll try and talk to some people from a law enforcement background, but, you know, it's probably unlikely I'll get to any people from a criminal background. And as it happened, you know, the further I went into it, I got some private sector people, and then eventually, you know, I got some law enforcement people, and I thought, wow, that's like really unexpected. I didn't think I'd be able to do that or do it in the time. And I thought, I really won't be able to get anyone from a criminal background. But in the end, I managed to get one person who was very clearly from a cyber criminal background, and another who was sort of fringe on the fringe side of things. But there's some luck involved as well. I mean, when you take on these types of things with these short timelines, you know, you have to work very hard and you have to be very persistent. But there's luck involved in terms of who responds, who you find, and whether you can make things work in the time that you have.
So I guess at some point through this process, the ghosts became people. Like you had your Scooby-Doo moment where you pulled off the mask and and suddenly they became real people. How did that develop? How did that change what you were interested in, the questions you started asking?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just by virtue of doing the study through these kind of traditional social science methods. So, you know, one of the things with cybercrime research is I think we often look at it and we say, okay, this is a new area, and there's these new forms of data that are really exciting, whether, you know, data from online marketplaces or forums or other types of digital data. Which is very exciting. It has been very valuable to the field in terms of new opportunities to study something. But I guess what I was doing with my approach was really doing things in a very old school way. Say, well, look, how have we always studied criminals and criminal groups? We've studied them through a range of techniques, including through interviews, through field work, through very traditional social sciences methods. So in a sense, I left others to take on the challenge of the new types of data and the new methods and some of that kind of side of things. And I went back to first principles. And it was by doing that, by taking this kind of interview mode, that really you have no choice but to engage with the human behind all of this. So partly when you start out talking to people in the private sector who are security professionals who are tracking cybercrime in different ways, or whether you engage with people who have law enforcement experience, at a certain point in time, they will, assuming they have the knowledge, tell you about different cases, which will lead you to different individuals. So people they might have interacted with directly, or whether it's people they were friendly with or close to in some way who ended up going down a criminal path. And so you get an introduction to the human and to the people involved through that. When you eventually come into contact with people who themselves have come from a cyber criminal background, that's when you're face to face with it. There's no question there as to that there are people behind these sort of online ghosts. And so, as I said, I got very lucky that in that first data collection period that I ever did, which was all in the UK, I managed to come into contact with a former cyber criminal. And that meeting, which is really, you know, I remember being a lot of anticipation before I did that meeting because I didn't know what that involved. And in reality, it involves meeting another human, as things always do. Cyber criminals are people too. A number of them actually very friendly, nice people, and you can have a very pleasant experience, you know, interviewing them for an hour or two. So having had this meeting, I think I began to realize the depth of knowledge that's contained by people who've inhabited this world themselves. That I think the method of doing interviews and physically meeting people in person. So you can do interviews, and I have done a number virtually in different ways, and there's different reasons why you might need to do that as opposed to in-person meetings. But when you do have these in-person meetings, you can't hide from the person because the person's right there in front of you. And I think that, to me, just doing this type of approach, doing these type of methods, made it very clear that this is a very human activity, and the technology can kind of obscure what's happening behind the scenes in social terms, but it's right there and it's foundational.
Humans, they spend time on the internet, but they also eat lunch and they sleep and they have a house. They live in a place in the real world. I'm trying to make the connection from how you got from meeting these people who were in virtual markets to then trying to find their place in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that I can also trace back to the very beginning of this, because one of the very first people that I interviewed, I remember, you know, at the time that I was doing these interviews, actually very little was known about cybercrime, because it was still emerging, but a lot of the cases that we kind of know about now hadn't been fully reported on. And so there was a lot of confusion as to what was happening out there. People didn't really have an idea of what the organization of cybercrime looked like in a kind of comprehensive way. And so I remember very early on one of the very helpful participants that I had, gave me a really good introduction and helped me understand a number of aspects of cybercrime. But one of the things that he said was that cybercrime is a universal problem. And so we're going to find it everywhere, and it's going to be largely the same everywhere. And this was something that ended up not being correct, but it ended up being really important for the research choices that I made. Because what this did was suggest that no matter what country I went to, no matter where I did data collection, no matter who I spoke to, we were likely to see the same types of things appearing over and over again. And so the first place that I went after I did this field work in the UK, and when I was starting to expand this study, I stopped in Singapore. And I did some interviews in Singapore. Now, if anyone knows anything about Singapore and crime, you'll know that, you know, crime control there is incredibly strong. And so there's actually very little crime there. There is pockets in different areas that have almost been sort of pushed there. But for the most part, this is not a place that you associate with large amounts of crime, certainly kind of local crime. And so when I went to do interviews on cybercrime in Singapore, it was perhaps not surprising to find out that there aren't really many Singaporean cybercriminals, and the types of cybercrime that they were worried about there was coming from elsewhere. And so immediately we had a counterpoint, which was that, okay, we may have places that are producing cybercrime at some level, like the UK, and then we appear to have at least one place that doesn't appear to be producing cybercriminals at all. And so from that immediate moment of contrast, it was clear to me that actually there was probably variation here, and that I needed to spend a lot of time investigating other countries as well and trying to understand what the situation was in relation to cybercrime in different countries around the world. And that's when you start building in not just an offline element, but a local element. So the offline is really important. And, you know, beginning with the stuff on the online is this kind of online puzzle. The further I went with the research and the more countries I went to, the more I realized how many of these cyber criminals knew each other in person in some way. So not only is it a matter of, okay, everyone, as you mentioned, exists somewhere, that they live somewhere, they eat food somewhere, they sleep somewhere. That's true. But they also have a tendency to work with people that they know in the physical world. So this is an area, while I was kind of doing this work through, you know, this sort of multi-country study, looking at this offline dimension, Rutger Luckveld in the Netherlands was doing work around the kind of case study method, and he was developing very similar findings. And we only kind of discovered each other and each other's work later on, so we didn't actually know at the time when we were doing this sort of data collection independently that we're finding very similar trends, which is quite good actually, because in a sense the different approaches led to similar outcomes around this sort of the real importance of the offline element, or in Rutger's work you might say the social ties. Existing social ties being really important to the organization and the cooperation within cyber criminal networks. And so that offline dimension became more and more obvious to me the further I got, the more countries I went to, the more interviews that I did. But tied to that is not just the offline, but also the local element. Then in each one of these countries, there appeared to be quite significant differences. I mentioned Singapore, that you find virtually no cyber criminal community. But in other countries, you might find, you know, strong cyber criminal community or a weaker one or some sort of moderate one. But you also find different specialties. You find certain countries where a particular type of cyber crime was very common. So I use an example like Romania, where online auction fraud was really quite dominant when I was studying things there, which is sort of the sale of products that don't exist on websites like eBay or Gumtree or otherwise. Whereas if you went to, you know, somewhere further in the east of Europe, whether it's Russia or Ukraine, you know, you might find more technical components of cybercrime, whether it's malware production or coding and different things like this. So as I kind of did this tour of the world, which ended up being 20 countries overall, and trying to visit a number of the kind of hotspots that are suspected of being really, really key parts of the cybercrime business, I really started to see that variation being very present, and to see the local dynamics really play out, that the kind of way the economy functioned or the way that life worked in a particular context really shaped the type of cybercrime and the type of cyber criminals that you saw there. So in a sense, it ended up being almost the complete opposite of what I was told by one of these very first interview subjects, that what we're seeing was a universal phenomenon that was the same area. I think what I saw in the end was that there was a huge amount of variation, and we're seeing different things in all different places all over the globe. And that to me was the big takeaway that drew this from something that was very much an online type of investigation to one that was really about linking that online with the offline and trying to understand the local dynamics therein.
That's a very powerful point, that offline context matters and every country is different. That really begs the question, what makes them different and how on earth would you find out?
Yeah. So the finding out is complicated. I mean, the way I went about it was in the first phase of the research, well, leaving aside the very first phase, which was just doing UK-based research, the second phase, in a sense, was to randomly go to countries. So as I mentioned, Singapore. But then I just kind of just wherever I happened to be traveling or weather was easy to travel, I was sort of testing out this theory of no variation. And so it didn't matter where I went. So I just went wherever was simple. But as I mentioned, once I started to figure out that there probably was going to be variation, it became a process of trying to use, I guess you'd call it expert opinion, but out of the interviews I was already doing, to try and listen to those people, particularly those that seem to be very knowledgeable about where are the places that cybercrime seemed to be produced in large levels. So what were the hotspots? And certain locations kept coming up quite regularly. So if you talk to law enforcement, or you talk to people who come from a cyber criminal background, they would start to give you pretty strong clues, not only about where they saw the most significant offenders coming from, but what they were kind of known for. So you'd start to hear, you know, about, as I mentioned, like Russia, about Ukraine, in terms of the more technical side of things. You would hear about Romania in terms of some of these fraud side of things. You'd hear about Nigeria, which I think is a very common example. Again, in terms of more fraud type of activity, I mean, originally we're talking about advanced fee fraud, this sort of email scams that people are very familiar with. That's the sort of original archetype of what Nigerian cybercrime is all about. And then you'd hear about some other types of examples. So China came up a lot, but that one was always a very confusing topic when it did come up, because there was this blurred area between, particularly at the time when I was doing the interviews I was doing, what was professional cyber criminal activity and what was state-based IP theft and these types of campaigns that had a strong political dimension. And so it was sometimes difficult when you interviewed people for them to piece apart whether they were talking about a criminal element there or whether it was actually a state element. I mean, now we know with what's come out, that a lot of these campaigns are politically backed, and that this was not necessarily a cybercrime hub in those terms. But that put China on my radar as at least somewhere that I needed to visit. And another one that came up was Brazil, which was basically one of the few examples outside of Eastern Europe or outside some of these other regions. It came up enough times where I thought, okay, this is a place that I need to visit, and this is a place that might present some interesting dynamics, which it actually did in the end. And so that was kind of how I went about doing this, was I started out broad and somewhat randomly, intentionally randomly, then started to narrow down through expert opinion where I needed to spend my time and my limited resources and what were the key places I need to visit. And then through those visits, it then refined it more as to whether maybe this is a place I should come back to, because it did seem to be somewhere where there was a lot of information that I needed to pick up on. Or in some of my other cases, it was like, this isn't such a good example. This is maybe people were slightly wrong on that. So that's kind of how I evolved the choice of locations and where I ended up going.
Do you think the differences that there are necessitate different approaches to both understanding and formulating potential interventions?
Possibly. It's a difficult question because we still don't know that much about the topic. But certainly there seems to be a division between countries where the offenders involved are quite technical and highly capable in the cyber sense of things. So if we think about Ukraine, Russia, really large parts of the former Soviet Union, what we're looking at there is a number of offenders involved, not all of them, of course, but a number that are highly educated. So in my experience and based on the research that I did, it suggested to me that a number of these people had degrees, some of them had multiple degrees. These are the types of individuals who you'd expect to be working in the technology sector. And sometimes they were, actually. They were moonlighting. They were doing both legitimate work and then also working in cyber criminal enterprises as well. And this was purely an economic problem, which was the education system was too effective in some sense, and the technology sector was not effective enough. So What I mean by that was the job market was weak. They weren't producing enough good and high-paying jobs to sustain the amount of talent that was being produced. And so what this led to is really this oversupply of technical talent, a lack of opportunity. And so instead of people being all absorbed into the tech sector, they create their own tech sector, kind of shadow, as I call it, a criminal Silicon Valley, where their opportunity comes through effectively cyber criminal startups. So either you have entrepreneurs who in another world would be doing legitimate startups and making really interesting products. They're doing cyber criminal startups. And then you have a large pool of coders and programmers and others who are employed by them effectively to provide this technical know-how and the skills that they need to run these businesses. And so in a sense, the type of offenders that you see there are quite unusual. They're unusual in terms of other types of crime, but they're also even unusual within cybercrime, just in terms of the technical capability and their effectiveness and efficiency. And you don't see that in a lot of countries around the world. So that's the case of really the former Soviet Union. But then if you look at other areas that are hotspots of cybercrime, you see different dynamics in play. So Romania is quite a good example, precisely because some of the elements and the kind of factors that you see within the former Soviet Union don't apply to Romania in the same way. So, you know, you have a similar situation where the technical training there is really good and they're producing really, really top level people. But the main difference there is the job market functions differently. You know, Romania is in the EU. They have access not just to the European market in terms of Romanians can go overseas and work in other parts of Europe. But there's also, I think, more opportunities for investment. And so what we see is not only do we have Romanians working in many countries around the world, really in some very top companies and doing really important work, we also see Bucharest as quite an important location for startups and having, you know, opportunity in the sense of Romanian businesses in tech as well. And so what's left when we look at what Romanian cybercrime is and isn't, we do see certain technical offenders coming out of Romania, but what they're really known for is the fraud offenders. And these people are, you know, they're capable and in certain cases educated, but they're not that technical elite. They're fraud guys. And this is a different type of world. So you can see just based on that comparison between Romania and certain countries within the former Soviet Union, that you're getting that different profile of cyber criminal. You're getting a different type of activity. Running an online auction fraud campaign is sophisticated in its own way in organizational terms. But ultimately, what you're looking at is putting up ads, trying to hook in victims, you know, selling them the thing that doesn't exist and then getting the money and getting it back to Romania. Whereas running, you know, malware campaign, designing some very sophisticated piece of software requires a very different skill set. And so that's a kind of illustration of that distinction.
So you've got kind of two proficiencies there that might be in different locales, which is sort of targeting the human and then targeting the machine. So that's one way to divide countries. What about the difference between countries that are old hands at this and places where this kind of culture is new? The established groups that you've been talking about in the Soviet bloc and maybe somewhere that's been popping up a little bit more recently, say like Vietnam.
Yeah, so there's kind of the potential for the emerging hotspots as well. So obviously, at any point in time, we take a snapshot of cybercrime, it's going to look a certain way in terms of where are the places in which cybercrime is coming out of. But that might change over time. So there may be hotspots that cease to be hotspots for some reason or other, whether there's, you know, greater opportunity emerges or otherwise, we may see some of those places recede as major producers of cybercrime. And then we may also see other places emerge in the sense that as the internet kind of spreads and the usage of the internet spreads further and further around the world, there might be places that are kind of that have the latent capacity to get involved in cybercrime, and there's this kind of community of people ready to go. But until the internet kind of takes root within broader society, they're not ready to go. So Vietnam is kind of an example that gets discussed from time to time. As a potential hotspot, it appears in certain sort of industry lists and things like this. In my mind, it's got certain components that give it potential, but it's not quite there, and it's unclear if it'll get to the kind of the fully fledged hotspot status. And so The main distinction between somewhere like Vietnam and somewhere like the former Soviet Union is you'll see certain elements of similarity around, you know, this relatively good technical education, particularly by regional standards in Vietnam. And you see a relatively large community of people interested in cyber, whether they're hackers or whether they have a broader interest in computing. And certainly there's a push in that direction in terms of education in Vietnam at the moment. But the question is it on the level of the former Soviet Union? And it's not. There's two things that distinguish it. One is that you don't have technical education at really that same level that you're seeing in Eastern Europe. I mean, the quality of the universities there in terms of STEM disciplines, in terms of maths and engineering and science and computing, we're not going to see that at this point in time in Vietnam. That may change in the future. But right now, that kind of entrenched history of STEM education is just such a big part of the former Soviet Union that's not to the same degree in Vietnam. So when we see that kind of pipeline of talent coming out of Vietnam, it's not at the same level, and so the threat's not going to be the same. But connected to that is, I think, in recent years, there's been growing opportunity in Vietnam in terms of cybersecurity opportunities, in terms of business and entrepreneurialism. And so there's potential other pathways for people with skill set, with people with talent and capability to pursue those legitimate avenues. And there's less of a pull into cybercrime. There's still a pull. And so we still see Vietnam sort of emerging in different cases of individuals based there and from there. But it's not at that level. So that's, to me, the main distinction is really the kind of quality, in a sense, of the people who are getting involved and the skills and the education levels, and then the numbers. And I don't think we're seeing a country like Vietnam really trying to compete with parts of the former Soviet Union yet. That's still, I would say, like a moderate cybercrime power, if we want to put it in those terms.
Right. They still have the option to make the next Flappy Bird game.
Exactly. There's, when I was there, basically, this was an attractive proposition. There was a Vietnamese guy who made a lot of money doing this, and so this is a model of how to succeed. So let's all try and do something similar. So it's kind of interesting in terms of the paths that people see that are available to them locally and the kind of models that they have of how to achieve success. And I think if the strong model is, and this goes back to the local element, if the strong model in your area is, well, crime pays and this is how you do it, and this is a kind of standard way of doing cybercrime and this is how we make money, and you'd see this story in some parts of Romania, there's certain towns that are just really, that's the local way of making a lot of money quickly. But, you know, if you have a model like this, like Flappy Bird, it can be, well, that's how you make money, and that's a legitimate way of making money. So that can almost divert a lot of people in that direction as well, in terms of innovation and really trying to make things that happen that way.
Crime online is seeming to be different all around the world, and there are different types of criminals in different places. Where do we go from here? What kind of research is needed to do more with this sort of growing understanding? And what kind of research are you planning on doing?
I mean, I think a lot of what I've been talking about is really scratching the surface. I mean, even though the work that I did, I mean, starting way back, I talked about 10 years ago, but the book that followed that, which took, 7 years of field work, and as I mentioned, visiting 20 countries, it was a very large undertaking. I'm not going to understate that. It was a big part of my life, almost a decade of my life. But as serious as it was and as much work as it was, what I realized was I was only really scratching the surface on a number of these topics. So if we talk about, we're talking about the offline dimension, we're talking about the local dimension, you're talking about the geography of cybercrime in some sense. You know, a lot of these things in terms of the hotspots, in terms of where cybercrime is coming from, where it's not coming from, again, this is a kind of estimation. This is based off interviews with very expert individuals. This is based off, a big qualitative study. But there's other ways of trying to confirm some of these types of findings. So I think for me, a lot of going forward, a lot of elements are really about realizing how enormous this field is. So people like to think of cybercrime as a niche field. And it still is relatively niche, I think, in terms of the numbers and the types of people involved in it. But there's so many topics that can be studied because what we're talking about is, as we talked about at the beginning, a hidden world. And once you start to realize what this world is, it's just like any other type of world in that it has core dynamics in terms of how it functions. And we're talking about a world that encompasses the entire globe. So we're talking about cybercrime existing in potentially in some form or another, all the countries of the world. And that means, in one sense, you could do a case study of virtually any country in the world and figure out, you know, what is, I really want to understand the local dynamics of cybercrime in this particular location, or even beyond just a country, you can start to narrow down into certain regions, or, you know, you can almost do an ethnography of a particular town or place that is well known for cybercrime. So there's a lot of opportunity for really expanding the reach in terms of the level of detail that we can provide on particular cases. So once we've even drawn a kind of rough map of what cybercrime looks like, there's so much opportunity for drilling down into the different components. And whether that's done in a kind of location-based way, or whether it's done through a methods type of approach. So, you know, there's also kind of endless methods that can be applied to cybercrime as well. So it's one of the things that I think got a little bit lost at the beginning. As I mentioned, you know, that this sort of focus on the new data and the new methods are available. And I think some really interesting work being done in that space. But there's certainly a number of social science methodologies beyond interviews, beyond ethnography, beyond participant observation, that can be applied to cybercrime. There's no reason they can't be. Basically, anything that we apply within the social sciences can be applied to cybercrime. And I think we've looked at this already within the literature to some degree in terms of the application of existing criminological theories. We can certainly look at the application of broader social sciences theories. But I think beyond that, almost any method that is usable within the social sciences is probably applicable to cybercrime in some way if you take the time to try and figure out how to apply it. And so I think a lot of the innovation going forward is going to be tied to studies that really drill down and are really rigorous in terms of trying to confirm certain things that we think are happening in cybercrime, but we don't really have that strong evidence base. And I'd say that applies to, you know, very, very many parts of this. And we really need to think more carefully about trying to confirm some of these sort of initial findings.
That's a call to action if I've ever heard one. Thanks for all your time and keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks very much.
Well, that left me with some really interesting ideas about cybercrime and where it's happening. I hope you are also re-examining some of those things that we just know. Once again, thank you to Dr. Listhaus for sharing time with us all. As always, you can check the show notes if you are looking for something that we mentioned in the show. This has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only made possible by the kind guests sharing their time and their research. If you do have a question or comment, you can reach me at cybercrimeology on Twitter or by old-fashioned email at cybercrimeology@gmail.com.